Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane.
Wile E. Coyote, super genius.
I like the way that rolls out. Wile E. Coyote, super genius.
Wile E. Coyote, super genius.
And with thanks to Mel Blanc, the hapless Wile E. Coyote was the first introduction many of us had to a uniquely American animal called many things: coyote, prairie dog, old man coyote, varmint. The coyote has been loved and loathed throughout its complicated history with humans, and yet it occupies a fascinating place in the story of this continent. Dan Flores has written Coyote America, a natural and supernatural history, and he joins us this hour of Radio Times. Welcome, Dan.
Hello, Mary. I'm very proud to be here.
We all know of Wile E. Coyote, don't we?
We do indeed. Many of us grew up with Wile E. as sort of a background Mobius loop in our lives.
Yeah. Well, as you point out in your book, coyotes are now found everywhere in the United States, maybe with the exception of Hawaii. And, you know, I live in South Jersey, Dan, and not too long ago, I was frankly astounded when a good friend of mine casually mentioned that there were coyotes living in the area who were being fed by construction workers. I had no clue. I had absolutely no clue that they were nearby, and I'm guessing I'm not alone.
No, you're not alone. I think a lot of people on the East Coast especially are discovering coyotes in their midst for the first time. So this is an unfolding story in America, and all I can say is you're just going to see them a lot more.
Tell us about this animal. Give us a picture of its intelligence, of what it does during the day.
Well, it's an animal whose evolutionary roots are purely American. So it goes back 5.3 million years in North America out of the canid family, which evolved here and that produced wolves and jackals and wild dogs and even our domestic dogs. They originally came from a family of animals from North America. But many of those other animals left the continent and ended up in Asia and Europe and Africa. Coyotes never did. They remained here, and they emerged as a distinctive species about a million years ago and have sort of been one of the primary players in the history of this continent ever since.
The key is they are incredibly adaptable. Tell us more about that.
Well, they're what biologists would call cosmopolitan animals. They spent evidently a lot of their early history as a species living in the American West, in the deserts and prairies of the West. But they very obviously have this unique ability, like us, in fact, to occupy a lot of different habitats. So they presently, in a migration that began at least a couple of hundred years ago, occupy the regions from the Arctic Circle to Central America, to Guatemala and Costa Rica. And that's a 7,000-mile range north and south. And now, of course, they have spread east and west from coast to coast.
Let's get into the coyote's history with human beings. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, at various times was loved, loathed. Let's get into the part in which the coyote is admired. The oldest deity on this continent is called Old Man America or Old Man Coyote.
That's exactly right. This is an animal whose history with human beings goes back at least 15,000 years to the time when the first Asians began to populate North America. And they encountered coyotes here because, as I mentioned, coyotes aren't found anywhere else around the world. And it's been really pretty much a roller coaster ride. I mean, this is an animal that's got a unique history, one that I've argued in the book is so complex and so rich that you almost can't think of any other species that can compare to it except probably for us. So it has this long period of respect and adulation by native people in the West who among all the animals available 10,000 years ago to serve as a kind of an avatar deity figure, they pick the coyote as the one that they think sort of channels and somehow functions as a stand-in for humans best of all. And as a result, our oldest literature in North America in the form of traditional stories by Native peoples is about this figure, as you mentioned, sometimes referred to as Old Man Coyote, or sometimes just Coyote with a capital C. But he's this fascinating figure, really, to me, a really intriguing deity, because he's not the sort of deity who's so good that humans are supposed to aspire to emulate him.
He's mischievous, isn't he?
Yeah, he represents the full range of human nature. I mean, he's benign and he's magnanimous, but at the same time, he can be jealous, he can be lustful, he can be mischievous, to be sure. And he's this kind of model of human nature, and that's the way the stories function in the lives of these people.
And then in early 19th century, the American West, you know, was actually a magnet for not only people who were settling, but European artists and naturalists. Could you tell us a bit about that?
The first Anglo-Americans who encounter coyotes and leave us a record, at least, were Lewis and Clark in 1804 as they traveled up the Missouri River. In the fall of 1804, they began to encounter the animals of the American West, mule deer, pronghorns. And one of the animals that they encountered that really puzzled them at first was the coyote. Their journals are full of references to seeing some new kind of fox for a couple of weeks. And then finally, one of the members of the group shot one. And with it lying in the grass in front of him, William Clark decided that, well, this is not a fox, to be sure. This is some kind of wolf. And so they gave it the name prairie wolf, which for most of the 19th century, in fact, as late as 1915, people in America were still referring to coyotes as prairie wolves. And so it became, for the next few decades, a topic of extreme interest on the part of naturalists, as you mentioned. Comes into science in 1819 as a result of the work of a naturalist named Thomas Say, who gave it its scientific name, Canis latrans. But a lot of naturalists on into the middle of the century thought that it might be actually some kind of jackal. And that debate wasn't resolved really until the 1850s.
Mm. Well, the sentiment toward the coyote was kind of going back and forth at the time between, it's a useful creature or it's vermin. What tipped the scale toward vermin?
Yeah, that's an intriguing part of the 19th century story, because Americans don't have any prior experience with this animal. I mean, we brought from Europe experiences, folk tales about bears, about wolves, foxes, many other animals, but we didn't have any prior experience with coyotes. And so it's intriguing to sort of track the story through the middle of the 19th century when lots of people are leaving us descriptions. I mean, Herman Melville has a description of prairie wolves in Moby Dick, and Francis Parkman does from the Oregon Trail. But they're kind of value-free because no one has quite figured out exactly what role they play in the great chain of being. But it's in the 1870s that we finally began to get an explanation for them that begins to tip the scales towards the vermin side.
Well, they were useful in keeping down, you know, rat populations and et cetera, correct?
They were, and there were some farmers in the West as early as the 1870s who realized that. I found newspaper accounts in the 1870s from the Utah Territory that indicated that farmers knew that this was the role that coyotes played. But the truth was, no one until the 1930s ever conducted any kind of real science on the natural history of coyotes. And so, I mean, in that kind of open field of little knowledge, we were free to just sort of ascribe it the traits that we wanted to. And those traits turned out to not be very good ones.
Well, overwhelmingly, the coyote was considered to be competition for ranchers. Could you get into that for us?
Well, when ranchers, especially sheep herders, began settling the West, they found that as American settlement had reduced the populations of lots of other species of animals, that coyotes and wolves both began to turn to domesticated livestock for their prey base. And so this is the real origin, I think, among the American livestock industry for a feeling of opprobrium about wild canids like wolves and coyotes. These sheepmen and cattlemen were attempting to raise their stock on western ranges, and coyotes and wolves, of course, were taking a pretty good share, especially of the young animals. And so the origins of hostility that have lingered on through our own time kind of come from that moment.
And the great extermination began. So what was used to get rid of coyotes?
Well, I mean, almost everything imaginable, everything that we could throw at them. I mean, especially following Mark Twain's description of them in the book Roughing It, we sort of enter a period from the 1870s into the 1920s or so, when coyotes began to acquire a really vile reputation in America. So vile, in fact, that by the end of that period, the proper course of action towards them seemed to be, let's wipe them off the face of the continent. Let's exterminate them.
Dan, we've got about a minute before the break. Do you think we've got time for you to read that passage from Twain that you've got in your book?
I think I do. It's a short little piece. So this is from Twain's Roughing It in the early 1870s. In Twain's view, the coyote's choice of homes defined him, for he lived chiefly in the most desolate and forbidding deserts. With the animal's suspect habitat laid out, Twain then hit stride in what became a classic description with a long reach in American culture. The coyote is a long, slim, sick, and sorry-looking skeleton with a gray wolf skin stretched over it, a tolerable bushy tail that forever sags down with a despairing expression of forsakenness and misery, a furtive and evil eye, and a long, sharp face with a slightly lifted lip and exposed teeth. He has a general slinking expression all over. The coyote is a living, breathing allegory of want.
I'm wondering if we can credit Twain, at least in part, for some sentiment against the coyote.
I think we very definitely can, as much as I hate to say so.
As much as we all love Twain, or many of us anyway. All right, Dan, yes. Dan Flores, we're going to talk with you some more in just a moment. We're up against a break here. Dan has written Coyote America, A Natural and Supernatural History. And if you have any coyote stories and you're listening, give us a call, 888-477-9499, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moss. Stay with us. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia, and I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. Dan Flores is author of Coyote America, A Natural and Supernatural History. The coyote has been alternately revered and vilified in American history, and we're talking about that this hour. If you'd like to give us a call, join the conversation. The number is 888-477-9499. Email works as well, radiotimes@whyy.org. Or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So Dan, you had just read a not very complimentary assessment of the coyote by Mark Twain. What is your opinion? What is your observation of the coyote? You've spent a long time studying this animal. Tell us what you think about this the coyote.
Well, I have been around them since I was a kid growing up in Louisiana, and probably, as I've told a handful of people, I began writing this book really maybe at the age of 12, 13, 14 years old, when I encountered the first coyotes I had ever seen in a place that, to me, as you related about your New Jersey experiences, that I never thought coyotes would occupy. As a 14-year-old, I saw one, the first one I'd ever seen in Louisiana, in my home parish. And so that's probably what intrigued me in the beginning. But having lived in the West for most of my adult life, I've been around them a lot. And I've really developed this kind of a fascination and respect for an animal that whose roots I know are very deep here. And as I argue in the book, I think the more you know about them, the more American you come, because this is so wonderfully an American story. And it's like, to me, seeing one is like getting to watch whales breach in the ocean, or taking a telescope out at night and seeing the Galilean moons circle around Jupiter. I mean, it's one of those great marvels of the natural world. And
tell
it's
us
kind
about
of,
when you see one. I'm sorry for interrupting. When you see one, what is that experience like? What are you seeing, and how is it viewing you?
Well, I mean, I think one of the first things you realize when you see one is that they're always looking at you. I mean, you have those yellow-orange eyes boring into you instantly. I've hardly ever seen a coyote that wasn't already focused on me first. And so you're exchanging this glance with an animal and somehow experience this deep knowledge that drops away, sheds away all the stereotypes, and allows you, if you let it happen, to have this unique and original experience, have an original relationship with the universe, if you will. And so if you drop away those kinds of stereotypes, you get an experience that will leave you often kind of standing and wondering for several moments. I mean, they just have that ability to transfix you.
So your sense is that they're assessing you, they're sizing you up.
You know, I think they've taken our measure for a very long time. And one of the reasons that people often have their reaction to them, that they're nonchalant. I mean, they will often, you'll see a coyote from 15 or 20 feet away, and often its reaction will be to look at you for a long moment, fix your gaze, and then it will turn and yawn and sort of amble off. And I think that sort of nonchalant attitude comes from the fact that they took our measure 15,000 years ago. They know exactly who we are. And so our task in this moment in time is to begin to understand who they are.
And despite what we might think they're thinking, the fact is, you know, despite the use of poisons like strychnine, and I think you write about something called Compound 80 and traps and bounty systems, they've managed to survive somehow and even thrive. Could you tell us more about that?
It's a really intriguing story. Yes, that intrigued a lot of people 100 years ago. The famous nature writer Ernest Thompson Seton wrote an article in 1900 in Scribner's Magazine where he tried to explain why at that time wolves were disappearing. We were effectively extirpating wolves. We had somehow seen bison disappear. We had seen elk and pronghorn and all these large animals, their numbers drop away. Even white-tailed deer in the east were almost invisible at that point. And yet coyotes seemed to be found in as great a numbers as ever. And Seton wrote this wonderful story in Scribner's, which was an allegory of that, where he used a little captive coyote as a kind of Moses figure who lived in a rancher's yard and learned all the tricks that humans used to try to exterminate them, and then got loose, found a mate, had a litter of pups, taught those pups all the tricks, and as Seton says, every generation of coyotes since has known all our tricks and known how to evade us. But the actual answer to that question, it's a wonderful allegory of it, but the actual answer is that coyotes have a suite of evolutionary adaptations that came from their long coevolution beside wolves that made it possible for them to adjust their numbers when their populations are suppressed.
How so?
And yes. And so the result is, for example, when coyotes howl, and they don't hear other packs howling, there is a hormonal transformation in them that causes the average size of their litters to go from 4 or 5 pups to as many as 15 or 16 or 17.
Hmm.
And they can therefore, when their populations are harassed and suppressed, they produce more offspring, and they go into a kind of a colonization mode where they scatter as singles and pairs across the landscape, which is, in effect, how this American extermination campaign has led to coyotes now being all over the continent. We have spread them as we tried to exterminate them.
And we'll talk about living with coyotes in the vicinity as we go on a little bit here on Radio Times. But you mentioned a coyote's howling. First of all, tell us what that experience is like. And secondly, I'm curious, I have not heard them in South Jersey, even though I know that they are in the area. So why do they howl in some places and not in others?
Well, I think if you listen long enough, and especially if you're out in the evenings and early mornings, you'll begin to hear them. I've gotten reports from lots of people on the East Coast who haven't yet seen coyotes, but what they have experienced is their howls. And so I say in the book, this is, perhaps my own conceit about it, but I think of the coyote's howl as the original national anthem. They've been howling it here for 1 million years, and so it's a tribute in a way to their long history in the place. But they howl just about every night. And I think if you go out in New Jersey and listen some, especially probably in the Pine Barrens area, you're very likely to hear them.
Yeah. So just briefly for you, the experience of a coyote howl. What is that like? What are you experiencing?
Well, I look at it this way. When I hear them, and I hear them almost every night and early morning in the Southwest near Santa Fe, New Mexico, where I live now. It's like when you hear the first group of howls, I mean, one of the experiences people always have is that it sounds like there are probably 15 or 20 animals howling, and they're maybe only 75 yards away from you, and it turns out there are only 2 of them, and they're probably a half mile away. So they have this sort of ventriloquist ability to project their voices and sound like there are many more than there actually are. But when you hear them, to me, in my imagination, it's always like I can picture this concentric ring of howls emanating from the first howls I hear, so that within a few hours, that concentric set of rings has extended now all over the Southwest, and since they're all over the continent now, ultimately to Florida, to the East Coast, to Maine, to the upper Midwest. There are coyotes responding in turn all over North America.
Hmm. All right, let's get to some calls. Cletus is in Bensalem. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you, Mary.
Sure.
You've got a terrific show, as always.
Yeah, thanks.
I can attest to the fact. Can you hear?
Yeah.
Am I on?
Yep, you're here.
Okay, great. I can certainly attest to the fact that, they have indeed, coyotes have indeed spread across the continent, because I saw one on Cape Cod up in Boston. I have relatives up there. And strangely enough, we've been talking about, the phenomenon of coyotes being on that island. At dinner, I went out for a walk after dinner, even though it was getting dark. It wasn't quite pitch dark. It wasn't late, around 9 o'clock or so. And sure enough, one just slunk out, just as Mark Twain described, and it transfixed me, and just stood there in this classic pose, one front leg up, and the other two braced, stared me down for a bit with the drooping tail, and just ambled off. It was exactly as your guest just explained,
yeah.
And boy, that was a, as I say, transfixing experience for me, and I knew it was a wild animal immediately, something in my bones just told me that, and
sure.
Sure enough,
so I'm curious, because Cletus, you use the word coyote. Some people say coyote. So how did you come about? How did you come to say calling coyotes or coyotes?
I'm glad you asked. I heard at some point along the way, and I'm getting older now, but I was always around, you know, the Boy Scouts, and it's nice to hunt. I wouldn't hunt now. But I at one point heard someone say they should be called kind of a combination of Spanish and American Indian, coyote, coyo, and te being, I guess, the Spanish part. And I never hear that, and I don't really use it that much other than just now, I guess.
Hmm. But well,
I've heard that.
We're up against the clock. So you know what I'd heard, Cletus and Dan Flores, is that you know, if you say coyote, it's almost like you're more on the side of preservation, and coyote maybe you don't like them so very much. And I'm not getting that sense from Cletus, but Dan, could you enlighten us a little bit as to the different terminologies?
Well, I try to track down in the book the origins of these two pronunciations that have become so common and widespread in the United States. I mean, the actual word, as Cletus mentioned, is actually an Aztec word. It's from the Nahuatl language, and the original pronunciation had been spelled C-O-Y-O-T-L, and in that language it's pronounced coyote with a silent L. And that word was brought to the Southwest by settlers there, particularly around Santa Fe and in New Mexico and in California. And Anglo-Americans began to encounter this new name for the animal that they had been calling prairie wolves sometime before the middle of the 19th century. And the Spanish version of that was three syllables. They took the Indian word coyote and turned it into coyote, coyote. And when Anglo-Americans heard it, especially the mountain men who were in the southern and central Rocky Mountains in the 1840s and 1850s, I think it sounded a little too fancy for them. And so they abbreviated it to two syllables, to coyote, and then took that back to the Midwest, the South, to Kentucky and Virginia, where many of them had come from. And I think especially in rural areas in America, the two-syllable version is the one that most people learn from the time they first knew there was an animal like that.
Okay, well, thanks for the clarification, Dan, and thanks for the call to Radio Times, Cletus. So, you know, they're not just found in rural areas. They are also found in cities. Which cities, and how?
How does this happen?
How does this happen? How do they survive in a city environment?
You know, since their primary prey base consists of rats and mice, they very early on discovered that living close to human beings was a good way to stay fed, because our houses, our villages, our cities produce an abundance of rodents. And so we know that coyotes, for example, the reason we have an Aztec name for them is that they were living in the Aztec cities 1,000 years ago. They've been urban animals probably for longer than that, but at least for 1,000 years, they've been living in our cities. And so it's not been a difficult thing for them to move into cities, but I trace the story really from places like Los Angeles across the country. I do a study of Los Angeles's coyotes and Denver's coyotes, Chicago's coyotes, and then their new frontier has been the boroughs of New York City. And so those four places kind of serve in my book to track this story. And it's been going on for a very long time in L.A. I mean, that city was founded in coyote territory to start with. Mm-hmm. And they've learned how to do extremely well in urban areas. And in fact, just to kind of go to the heart of the matter, it turns out that living in cities is a much easier lifestyle for coyotes than being in rural areas where they're often shot or trapped or poisoned to this day. So they live much longer in cities. They have bigger litters in cities. They're kind of discovering that city life is the equivalent of living in a national park for them.
And with this in mind, let's get to Brian in Roxborough. Hi, Brian. You're live on Radio Times.
Hi. I have a place in Roxborough on the western edge of the city limits, and there's like 300-acre nature preserve, on one side of me. The power lines are below that. There's a lot of open space. And one morning last fall, I came, pulled into my driveway, and there was a, not a fawn, but not a large deer that was eviscerated, and its guts were pulled aside, and all the meat in its legs were gone. And I couldn't believe what I was looking at. And I thought, what could have possibly done this? And I decided it must be coyotes, although I've never heard them out there. I've never seen them. It seemed like too big a job for a fox. I don't think we have wild dogs out there. But and then my concern immediately was for my dog that is about 20 inches high, 20 inches long, 25, 30 pounds. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, oh, wow, she runs after deer. She disappears. She always comes back. And I'm thinking, can these things lure her out there? And
these are all good questions, Brian, and I'm going to have to stop you because we're close to a break. But Dan Flores, a number of things brought up. Yeah, Brian's not sure that the carcass was actually the result of a coyote, and I'm not sure if you know quite enough about how they feed to give us your thought on that. But, you know, the fact is if people just think coyotes are in the area, they immediately start to think about their pets, and that's a, you know, that's a very real concern.
It is indeed. Coyotes do attack small dogs, sometimes medium-sized dogs, and they certainly will attack cats, but there are very specific reasons for them to do so rather than to eat those animals. And if you'd like to save this for after your break, we'll do it.
Yes, why don't we do that? Thank you so much. Dan Flores is our guest. He's written Coyote America, A Natural and Supernatural History. And again, the lines are open at 888-477-9499. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in today for Marty Moscawain. Stay with us. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscawain. And Dan Flores is with us. He's author of Coyote America, A Natural and Supernatural History. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number to call is 888-477-9499. Or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Dan, I'd like to pick up on something that we were talking about just going into the break. And that is, you know, coyotes in the proximity, pets, and you were starting to talk about small animals like dogs, and you were saying that coyotes won't necessarily go after them as prey for food. Why would they go after pets?
Well, in cities, just as in rural areas, coyotes establish territories, usually at the center of which is the den where they raise pups. And so, and what they're doing in those territories, I mean, a pair of alpha breeding animals or a pack, which often consists of the alpha animals and the pups from the previous year, will establish a territory and attempt to keep other coyotes and other predators out of that territory. And so what's often happening when coyotes attack dogs and cats is that they're not going after them to eat them. They're going after them because they regard them as competitor predators that have entered their territories. And that's especially crucial during the late spring and summer months when coyotes are raising their litters. That's the time when they're usually most aggressive towards dogs and cats because they feel that an encroaching dog might be a threat to their pups. So people have to be, and in order to coexist with coyotes, and we're all going to have to do that because we're powerless to resist them. They are here among us, and they're going to be here. We have to learn how to coexist with them. And one of the things that you have to do is to learn enough about them to understand their natural history and what's happening in an encounter with them. And so people do need to keep their dogs, especially small and medium-sized dogs, up at night, not let them run deer or chase prey into the woods. And in terms of cats, of course, as the biologists who have been studying this phenomenon have increasingly argued, one of the side benefits of this is that as feral cats are shrinking in numbers, when coyotes show up, the number of songbirds in urban places is beginning to skyrocket as a result of that.
What are some other things that we as humans should do to prevent unpleasant incidents? I mean, they, you know, some of us might regard them as very attractive animals, and maybe we'd be tempted to feed them. Is that a new? I'm assuming that's a no-no.
That is a no-no. You mentioned something about the workers,
construction workers
in New Jersey, who were feeding them. It's exactly the wrong thing to do with coyotes. I mean, it produced an effect in Los Angeles in the 1980s and 90s where something like 70 people got bitten by coyotes because they had begun feeding them, had habituated them to coming to homes looking for food, and often when that food didn't materialize, they would sort of run through a yard and snap at somebody sitting in a lawn chair. So the last thing we want to do is to feed them. We want to keep them eating their wild prey, eating rats and mice and rodents and sometimes fruit. And we want to make sure that even in the cities where they're around us, that they, if they don't exactly fear us, that they at least think we're a little too weird to trust. And so you don't want to let them come too close. If they are standing 15 or 20 feet away and not moving away from you, then you want to throw up your arms and shout at them or throw a rock and keep them wild, because they are in truth wild animals.
Okay. We've got an email from Lenny, who's in Allentown, and Lenny asks about how coyotes and foxes get along because both live in her suburban neighborhood. Do you know, Dan Flores?
Well, there's a hierarchy of canids in North America, and coyotes stand in the same relationship to foxes, both red foxes and gray foxes, that gray wolves stand in relationship to coyotes, which is to say the bigger dog is always going to harass and chase the smaller canid. And, I mean, I can give you one example between gray wolves and coyotes. We had a 75-year period in Yellowstone National Park when gray wolves had been extirpated and there were only coyotes in the park. Coyotes in those circumstances, when they're not harassed by either other predators or humans, they reach a level carrying capacity population that doesn't climb. It doesn't grow. It stays at just about the same level. Hmm. But as soon as we introduced gray wolves back into the park in the middle 1990s, the numbers of coyotes in about 3 years' time dropped by almost 60% as a result of wolf harassment. And sometimes, I mean, wolves even dug up their dens and killed coyote puppies in their dens.
And before we get back to the phones, you, in your book, you talk about the grand killing tests of the 1870s and the 1880s. Why did gray wolves fare so poorly compared to coyotes?
Well, that's a wonderful question, actually, which gets at the natural history of the two respective animals. Gray wolves are much more pack-oriented animals. In fact, we know that they have far more facial expressions than coyotes do because of their social interactions with one another. And so when hunters began to go after gray wolves to wipe them out, they discovered that they could, if they caught a single or trapped a single member of a pack, they could use the scent from that animal to proceed to catch every single other member of the pack. Coyotes respond to that sort of thing, though, by employing what biologists refer to as fission fusion techniques. They oftentimes will form packs as a fusion group to accomplish a large goal, like running down a deer. But when they're pressured, their response is often to go into fission mode, which is to scatter into pairs and individuals and sort of colonize across the landscape. And so they turned out to be far more susceptible to this pack technique of trying to wipe them out.
Well, we've got a lot of calls coming in here, Dan Flores. It seems everybody's got a coyote story. So let's go to Vince in Haddon Heights, New Jersey. Hi, Vince.
Hi, how you doing?
Well, thank you. So what's your question or story?
Well, you guys brought back some memories. I worked on a college co-op in New Mexico. It was a 68,000-acre ranch, and we would go out and check cattle, and you would try to call or look for cattle that had problems. And one of the tools you used, as Dan may know, is a paint gun. And I remember the guy I was with, one day we came up on a coyote, and this was all foreign to me, of course. And he just went ballistic, chasing this coyote down with the truck and the paint gun and hitting it. And I knew at the time it was just this vilified period of time for these coyotes. And it just felt wrong, but it was just so pervasive in the culture that was what you did. And I remember going back. Ranch was huge, but like days later, and we saw the coyote carcass. And I just never felt right about it, but I just remember that story, and it was you brought back those memories of that. And maybe Dan, I'm just wondering if they still do that today.
Thanks for the call, Vince. Yeah, a paint gun seems like actually one of the milder weapons used against coyotes. But tell us what you think.
Well, I mean, people are inclined after a century of basically having learned to hate these animals with a passion, especially in the West, they're inclined to use anything at hand. I mean, a paint gun was probably the only thing he had that he could grab and fire at the animal, at least to mark it. I mean, it's has been bad enough in the West and still is in a lot of places where a coyote will run across a road in front of a car. I've been in pickup trucks with people, and I've as a driver would swerve around to keep from hitting the coyote and have my companion from the other seat shout out, well, hit the SOB, run over the SOB. Don't let that coyote run across the road without trying to run it over, in other words. I mean, this is a holdover from a time when the federal agency that was responsible for trying to exterminate them mounted a publicity campaign across the country to convince us all that this was an animal so despicable that it didn't deserve to be alive and breathing up good air in America. And so many of us are, we're still in the downstream effects of that kind of hatred. We're only, I think, now beginning to step back from this and have original experiences with these animals and realize the role that they actually play.
Well, Dan Flores, does the coyote cost the ranching industry? Is it a threat that does need to be taken care of? It is a business. It is an agribusiness. And many of us go to the store and, we purchase meats for dinner. So is there something to that?
Well, it does. There's no question coyotes affect the livestock industry. It's a sort of, in a way, some of us think of it as a natural cost of doing business on the Western range with something of the intact ecology still there. It's mostly Wildlife Services, which is the agency that still kills 70,000, 80,000 coyotes a year.
It's a government agency?
A federal agency, that's mm-hmm. right. Our taxpayer dollars are funding that. And it does so primarily for the sheep industry. And the sheep industry in America, at one time we had 55, 60 million sheep in the United States before the beginning or about the time of World War II. At present, we only have about 5 million sheep in America. But nonetheless, Wildlife Services continues with helicopters and planes and poisons to go after coyotes and kill almost 100,000 of them a year. And so what a lot of us argue for is pushing this agency. Obviously, livestock people want it to do something, but pushing the agency toward non-lethal control methods rather than just the sort of traditional, okay, we're going to go out and kill the animal.
Mm-hmm. Let me get to just a couple more comments before we wrap up the show. Paul from Philadelphia called in to ask about whether coyotes breed with dogs. And by the way, he says there are definitely coyotes in Philadelphia. So do you have crossbreeding there?
They do interbreed with dogs. Coyotes, it's a very interesting story, and it's related to their evolution. They freely interbreed with remnant eastern wolves, like red wolves and eastern wolves in Canada and in northern New England and upstate New York. So we have an emerging animal in the East that a lot of people are calling a coy wolf, which is about 70% coyote in terms of genetics. And the rest of its mix is usually about equal eastern or southern wolf and domestic dog. And so it's a slightly larger animal than the western coyote. It does a good bit better in terms of hunting deer, but it has a coyote's cleverness and intelligence. And so it's able to survive around us in ways that wolves never were able to.
Let's squeeze in one more call. Doug in Springfield, New Jersey. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, good morning, and thank you. It's a very interesting show. One observation and then a question. Interestingly enough, I'm lucky enough to be someone who has seen a coyote, but I saw the coyote in the Bronx, New York. Our daughter goes to Fordham, and we were coming home getting on the Bronx River Parkway, and it ran across in front of us.
Huh.
And I was with I was with my fiance, and she said, "That's a coyote." And, of course, I thought she was crazy. But I got out the phone and I Googled it, and sure enough, she was right.
And I take it we're not talking about a park area. You're talking about something.
No, this was an intersection between, between East Fordham Road and the Bronx River Parkway, right by the Bronx Zoo. And the coyote was actually leaving the Bronx Zoo and going into the middle of the intersection. And I had done a quick bit of reading after that, and I intend to read the book because it sounds fascinating. That in the urban environments, they actually use clover leaves as habitat. So that's my question. Is that true? Is that something that's common? Does the author have any thoughts on that?
All right. Thanks for the call, Doug. Dan?
Well, that's a description from the coyote's new frontier. I mean, they're in Queens. They're in the Bronx. They're in Brooklyn. I mean, they're everywhere in all the boroughs. Probably not a huge population yet, but it's growing. They're using clover leaves. They're using any kind of edge where there's a bit of native grass or prairie open space left, traveling a lot by along rail lines, which is how we think they probably crossed the Harlem River, for example. So, yes, they're able to. I mean, these are very, very intelligent animals. In the Southwest, Hispanics in that part of the world say the only thing smarter than a coyote is God. So these animals can figure out how to maneuver through the biggest, noisiest urban landscapes on the planet and do it really well and easily.
Curious, where do they have their dens?
Well, they sometimes will den in cities in culverts, in rain gutters. They find all kinds of unique spots. There was one on top of a bar in Queens about 15 months ago that evidently was had a den. At least it disappeared through the broken window glass of an abandoned building whenever the wildlife people showed up to capture it.
And Dan, as we wrap up the hour, again, your thoughts on coexisting with this creature, which is a wild animal. Just a couple thoughts.
It is. Resistance is futile. They are here to stay. And I think we should delight in having wild, small wolves in our midst.
But keep them at arm's length.
Yes. Keep them wild.
Dan Flores, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Mary. It's been a pleasure.
And Dan is author of Coyote America, A Natural and Supernatural History. By the way, if you didn't get a chance to get in on the conversation and you want to add to it, check out our Facebook page. It's there for you. Also offers a great behind-the-scenes look at Radio Times. You find the Radio Times Facebook page at whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers are Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, sitting in for Marty Moscawain on Radio Times.